Hello there and welcome. Today is Thursday, April 25th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the leaders of Russia and North Korea meet today for their very first summit, but what will come out of it? U.S. President Donald Trump continues to defy Congress in refusing to turn over subpoenaed documents from Congress.
I do not recall anything like this in my professional career.
Also ahead, Sting is about to make a big move of residency. It's all on today's International Edition. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un will meet Russian President Vladimir Putin Thursday today at a summit designed to show that Washington is not the only power able to set the agenda on Pyongyang's nuclear program. The two men will sit down together on an island off the Russian Pacific city of Vladivostok 2 months after Kim's summit with U.S. President Trump ended in disagreement and cooled hopes of a breakthrough in the decades-old nuclear row. The summit, the first ever between Putin and Kim, provides Pyongyang with an opportunity to seek a new avenue of support, Russia, and possible relief from the sanctions hurting its economy. For the Kremlin, the summit is a chance to show it is a global diplomatic player, despite efforts by the U.S. and other Western states to isolate it. VOA Asia's Ira Melman asks Harry Kazianis, Director of Korean Studies at the Center for National Interest, what we are likely to take away from the meeting, or if it's all just theatrics.
I think the most important thing that's going to come out of this is actually the pictures. In fact, I'm actually calling it the selfie summit, because there's not going to be a lot of substance out of this. There's going to be a lot of pictures, there's going to be a lot of buzz on social media, but as to actually changing the status quo in Northeast Asia, as for giving Kim Jong-un any sort of economic relief or sanctions relief, I have to be honest, that is not going to happen. Those types of things would have to be granted by the UN Security Council, and that takes a unanimous vote. So just Russia and Kim meeting, while it is an important marker historically, is not going to change things for Kim, unfortunately.
So what is in it for both leaders?
Well, I think both of them want to show that they have options. Specifically, Kim Jong-un wants to show to Donald Trump that he has other people out in the world that he could go to, maybe in the future for potential aid if sanctions were to be removed. And I think for Vladimir Putin, the same thing is obvious. He obviously does not have a good relationship with the United States. So what he is trying to do is to do the same thing, to show that he has options. Essentially, both countries want to have a Russia card and the other wants to have a North Korea card. The question here is, though, is what can each of these countries do for each other? At the moment, not much. I mean, Russia has its own economic problems. They're not able to invest billions of dollars, say, into North Korea. They don't have the money and they'd be breaking sanctions. And as for North Korea, they only offer really Russia headaches more than anything else. So this is about pomp and circumstance and pictures and not substance.
What has happened to what apparently had been a relatively close relationship between North Korea and Moscow? What happened to it, and why does Kim and Putin want to bring it closer?
Well, simply that the Soviet Union's death in 1991 pretty much ended the old relationship they had. We have to keep in mind the whole reason North Korea has nuclear weapons and long-range missiles is because in one shape or format, they came from the Soviet Union. It was Soviet scientists, when the Soviet Union actually collapsed in the early 1990s, that went to North Korea and taught the North Koreans how to build nuclear weapons. In the 1950s and 60s, it was Soviet Union's nuclear technology that went into North Korea to build nuclear reactors and those things. So essentially, Moscow gave birth to this problem. But really, in the years since the end of the Cold War, the relationship has been very dormant. The Soviet Union obviously couldn't give aid when they were collapsing. And that is actually one of the reasons North Korea went into a large famine in the 1990s. And up to 1 million people actually died because they were not getting that food aid. So they are trying to reboot the relationship, but it's a far way off from where it was in during the Cold War days.
Does this meeting change the balance of power as far as negotiations and just relationships between Russia, between North or South Korea, the United States, and China?
The only thing that could happen here, and you're starting to see inklings of this, is that the Russians may call for what are called the six-party talks to be resumed. This is something that happened in the early to mid-2000s, when countries like Russia, Japan, China, the United States, and others all got together to try and solve the North Korean nuclear problem. They failed, and they failed miserably. The North Koreans actually used these talks and dragged them on for years. And while this was happening, they built up their nuclear program. So you could see Russia and China and some other countries try to use this as essentially as a bargaining tool with the United States. And I just hope we don't fall for it this time.
What about the visits of Kim to have meetings with the leaders of these various major powers? Has this elevated his stature either domestically or internationally?
Both. And I want to know whose PR rep is, because they're doing a fantastic job. Not only are they humanizing Kim, but you can see him slowly adopting more Western clothes. He looks more as if somebody that could even be approachable. And considering this is a man that has potentially 250,000 people in Stalinist sort of prison camps, that's a big feat to pull off. So the more of these visits he does, the more countries he goes to in his so-called armored car, he's being humanized. He's looked as a so-called legitimate world leader. And that's pretty troubling, to say the least.
All right. That is Harry Kazianis, Director of Korean Studies at the Center for National Interest. Meanwhile, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said Wednesday that U.S. talks with North Korea would be bumpy, but he expressed hope there would be several more chances to discuss how to move forward to the country's denuclearization. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. More than 60 people have died in South Africa after heavy rains. Immunization is under the microscope. The UN evacuates refugees from a Tripoli detention center. And Trump says he is holding Big Pharma accountable in the opioid fight. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. President Trump says his White House will be fighting all the subpoenas issued by House Democrats in their investigations into his administration. Trump is criticizing those investigations and telling reporters at the White House that he thought after 2 years we'd be finished with it. Democrats have stepped up their inquiries in the aftermath of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into Russian interference into the 2016 election. And the White House is pushing back on other fronts, including House Democratic efforts to obtain Trump's tax returns and his business's financial records. Joining us now to understand the legalities of all of this is Robert Deitz, former National Security Agency attorney and currently a professor of governmental affairs at George Mason University. Thank you for being with us. Do we have any precedents for anything like this?
I do not recall anything like this in my professional career. There was a case, I think in 1880, in which the Supremes said they would not enforce a Hill subpoena. And they did it on the ground that the Hill was not looking at anything with a legitimate legislative interest on the part of the Hill. That case, apparently, I read in the newspaper, was cited by the president's lawyers. Now, the interesting thing is that case was expressly overturned sometime in the 20s, and the Supreme said Congress can investigate anything it wants. And that is the extant precedent. Mm-hmm. And so it seems to me that all lower courts would be obligated to follow that Supreme Court precedent, saying, of course, Congress can look at this stuff. And my instinct is the Supreme Court would not change its mind.
We have three co-equal branches of government.
Yes.
And Congress is charged with oversight, particularly in the House. So if they issue subpoenas, is that any different than any other legal subpoena that may be handed by a legal entity?
As a general rule, no. Now, again, there is a Supreme Court precedent, roughly now 100 years old, that says that Congress is entitled to obtain any information that it's interested in. And if precedent no longer to hold, it would require the current Supreme Court to state that. And my instinct is the court would be exceedingly reluctant to do that because, as you point out, Congress is a co-equal branch of government. And the stuff that was uncovered covered in the Mueller report certainly provides reasonable grounds for Congress to say we need to take a look at this stuff for legislative purposes.
They have a right to request and they have a right to subpoena the information and documents that they feel they want. And if the president says this is a settled issue with the Mueller report and it's ridiculous and you're just doing this for political reasons, can he just refuse?
He can refuse, and then the next step is going into court to enforce the subpoena. With respect to refusal, that question gets very interesting. He can certainly instruct White House staff not to respond to subpoenas. He no longer has authority over Mr. McGahn because Mr. McGahn is no longer in the White House. But so the president would need to use some other technique, and that technique is to claim executive privilege. But that's not all that easy either, because ultimately courts can look at claims of executive privilege, as the Supreme Court did in the Nixon case.
If they're subpoenaing documents and the White House is refusing to turn them over, what recourse do Democrats have?
It gets complicated. Normally, refusals to obey congressional subpoenas are referred to the U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia. Now, he or she is under the authority of the Department of Justice, meaning the Attorney General. And I don't think this has ever happened, but I can imagine that the Attorney General could say, instruct the U.S. Attorney, do not take this case. And at that stage, we are in uncharted territory. I suspect the House would first then go use its own attorneys to seek enforcement. But even then, things get unclear. What if there's an order by a court for the president to turn over various materials, and he says, I ain't doing it? Then what?
Right, because this has never happened before.
Correct.
Usually the White House understands that this is Congress's job.
And normally the White House has respect for the rule of law.
Mm-hmm.
Bear in mind, Richard Nixon turned over tapes that he must have known were going to implicate him in a serious way in the cover-up of Watergate, and yet he complied.
Sort of stunning to where we don't know where this is going to go because it's never happened before.
Right.
What about the president telling staffers to refuse to comply with requests for their testimony on some of these issues? And if you were their attorney, what would you recommend? Would you recommend them keeping their jobs and listening to the president?
That's a tricky one. I'm not sure. Normally, the head of an agency can give instructions to its people, but a subpoena is not a request. It's a demand. And I am not sure whether a staffer working for the president could just simply say, I'm not doing it because the president has told me not to.
All right. That's Robert Deitz, former National Security Agency attorney and currently a professor of governmental affairs at George Mason University. As the World Health Organization marks World Malaria Day today, Malawi has launched a pilot phase of Africa's first ever malaria vaccine. The World Health Organization chose Malawi alongside Ghana and Kenya because of the high numbers of malaria cases and treatment facilities. The pilot phase aims to vaccinate 360,000 children per year, 120,000 of them in Malawi. But as Lamech Messina reports from Lilongwe, while the vaccine is expected to save thousands of lives, its effectiveness is limited.
Malawi this week launched Africa's first World Health Organization-approved malaria vaccine at Likun Hospital. It took more than 30 years to develop a vaccine against malaria, a mosquito-spread parasite that kills over 430,000 people per year, most of them African children. The vaccine, known as RTSS, is only helping children under 2 years of age who receive 4 doses at months 5, 6, 7, and 22.
After we did clinical trials, we had several age groups that we looked at. This vaccine was seen to be very, very effective in children aged between 5 months and 22 months. In other age groups, it didn't really show usefulness.
Malawi's mothers are excited about the potential of the malaria vaccine.
Malaria is a deadly and killer disease, not only to children, but to us adults as well. Although I have other children who are not vaccinated, I feel lucky to have this one protected from malaria.
but the vaccine is only effective in 40% of cases.
So this new vaccine is just an additional tool to the control and elimination of malaria in this country. So whoever will get this vaccine, all the children that will get the vaccine, we encourage them to still use other malaria prevention methods, like sleeping under mosquito nets, getting to the hospital quickly when they have fevers or they have body aches.
Despite its partial protection from malaria, in Malawi, the vaccine is expected to make a huge impact.
This vaccine has a potential of preventing 1 million cases. And at the moment, we experience 6 million cases.
Like many in Africa, Malawi's healthcare is overrun with malaria cases, which make up to 40% of hospital admissions and 30% of outpatient visits. Most of them are children under 5 years of age. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Lilongwe.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
With David Bandy.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and The Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, in 1920, American women gained the right to vote. The historic milestone was the culmination of decades of struggle by women working in both state and national levels for political empowerment. Now, a major new exhibit at the Smithsonian's National Portrait Gallery in Washington examines that complex history ahead of the 100th anniversary of that momentous event. VOA's Julie Tabou has more.
As American civilization marched into the new century, the women of the land began to demand a measure of equality with the men.
The path for women fighting to gain the right to vote in America was a long and difficult one. It took decades of struggle by activists like Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and Lucy Stone. Now, a major new exhibition at the Smithsonian's National Portrait Gallery in Washington is presenting a rich visual history of the women's suffrage movement over a span of 130 years.
The women's suffrage movement just didn't appear out of nowhere. You know, they had these abolitionist foundations, they had partnerships with the temperance movement, and that is really how they built momentum across the country in the very early stages.
The seven-room exhibit features more than 120 objects from 1832 to 1965. Photographic portraits and paintings, books, banners, and posters provide an in-depth look at the people and events that helped shape American history. How many people know, for example, that Victoria Woodhull was the first woman to run for president on a third-party ticket in 1872? Or that activist Lucy Burns served 6 different prison sentences for picketing the White House? And that a group of American women staged the first major nonviolent march on Washington in 1913?
Black women were organizing just as much as white women.
About a third of the collection represents women of color, including African Americans, who were often excluded by white women from major suffrage organizations.
This exhibition works to show a more complete history of the women's suffrage movement by looking at biographies of African Americans, Native Americans, and other women of color to complement the better known story that we have in our textbooks.
African American women like abolitionist Sarah Parker Raymond, who filed one of the earliest lawsuits protesting race segregation, Ida B. Wells, who advocated for federal laws against lynching, and Mary Church Terrell, who established the National Association of Colored Women. Today, American women have immense political power. They make up a huge voting bloc. More than 120 women now serve in Congress, and many others are in major leadership roles.
If you start from where the exhibition starts in 1830s, and then trace that thread with the suffrage movement up to this very day when women are actually leading our country, you can see the great continuum and the grand sort of narrative journey that these women had to undergo to achieve that. And I'm really excited to see what happens from here on.
Julie Tabo, VOA News, Washington.
Well, a once extinct heirloom grain is making a major comeback in the American South and becoming a gourmet part of the cuisine. I talked about it with reporter Amy Gutman, who says a modern milling pioneer in South Carolina is leading this regional grain renaissance of Carolina gold from a once extinct heirloom rice that's rooted in local history. Amy, what is Carolina gold rice?
This is a story about a rice renaissance, if you will. So Carolina gold rice is a grain product from the South, from South Carolina originally, that was very popular in the early days just after the Civil War, but went extinct essentially. Interestingly, it's a byproduct of a long grain variety of rice. And this was a South Carolina cash crop until just after the Civil War. This Carolina gold rice, the original form of it was notoriously difficult to harvest and process without breaking because it was a long grain rice. And of course, that's what made it so special. Workers earn more money the less breakage they had of this grain. But ultimately, a lot of these grains of rice did break because it was just impossible for them not to when they were being harvested and processed. And what's so interesting about this rice, those broken bits of rice that actually proved to be very valuable and formed the basis for this first regional cuisine of the South called Carolina Rice Kitchen that emerged in the 19th century as a result of these broken bits of rice, which when cooked low and slow, as the saying goes, turned into this really creamy, almost grit-like texture.
What was the cuisine like?
Carolina Rice Kitchen represents a real melting pot. So it arose when three distinct rice cultures came together to build rice canals on the sea islands of Carolina and Georgia. There were Venetian rice farmers who designed the canals. There were Africans who used their rice management methods. And there were Native Americans who worked in the fields. And the result of these three fused cultures was a vibrant exchange of flavors that became this new cuisine, Carolina Rice Kitchen. And much of that West African influence remains today in South Carolina in foods like things called Benny wafers. These are sesame wafers. The word Benny is the West African word for sesame. Boiled peanuts, that's another thing that's very West African and still very popular in South Carolina. But it's the Carolina gold rice that's the hallmark of this cuisine.
How did all of this come about? How did it get revived?
There's a gentleman named Glenn Roberts who's a furniture restorer, and he had grown up over the years hearing his mother speak rather sentimentally of Carolina gold rice and how creamy and delicious it was and how much she longed for it. But as bakers modernized and switched to wheat and more traditional modern grains, Carolina gold rice died out. People were consuming rice less. So Roberts, years ago, began Anson Mills. This was his mill, essentially, to produce the rice. And he's been able to convince and persuade local chefs to work with him and use Carolina gold rice ever since. And now it's become a very trendy ingredient to use in recipes on the menus of upscale restaurants and even just regular restaurants. So it's all over menus in Charleston and throughout South Carolina, but it's even traveled as far as Brooklyn. So Carolina gold rice is really having a moment in American cuisine.
All right. Reporter Amy Gutman, thanks so much for being with us. Grammy-winning superstar Sting will be in Sting City, no longer Sin City, Las Vegas. He's heading there to launch a residency next year. 16 performances of Sting My Songs will take place at the Coliseum at Caesar's Palace beginning in May of 2020. He tells the Associated Press that he's been offered a residency in Vegas in the past, but felt it wasn't the right time and now likes the idea of performing at a single venue every night compared to traveling city to city on a normal tour.
I've played Vegas many, many times over the years. always enjoyed it, but I've never had my own room before. That's an exciting potential, because we can make it our own room. We can basically have carte blanche to do whatever we like. I'm just excited by the limitless possibilities of that space and what we can do in it visually, sound-wise, dancing. It's going to be a Vegas show, and I'm really committed to that. Having a residency, having your own, welcoming people into your house, that's basically what it's going to be. I'll be telling the story of my life through songs, and I've had a long and interesting life, and I can't wait. It's been offered to me for many, many years, and I always think, well, I'm not quite ready for that. You know, I'm still a touring animal. I'm ready. I think just being in one place will allow me to explore creative ideas to a much deeper level, much more profound.
All right, well, residencies in Vegas were once meant for acts heading to retirement or in the final stretch of their careers, but that has changed with contemporary artists going to the city to perform, from Jennifer Lopez to Lady Gaga. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Hello, this is James Butte, Managing Editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa show. Join us Monday through Friday at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC as we bring you the latest Africa news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our mail segment by sending your comments to daybreakafrica at voanews.com. You can call us on 001-202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. That's Daybreak Africa at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Join your host, Larry London, for Border Crossings, VOA's Worldwide Music Request Hour, every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in to hear your favorite songs and artists, win prizes and giveaways, and get the latest scoop from exclusive celebrity interviews. Send in requests to our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or call 202-618-2077 to have your favorite music played for the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal.